Drake R4C receiver with the built-in auxiliary noise blanker. Have you ever had one of those in your hands? And did you say you had to have it? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I had Drake. I had the 2Bs, PR4s, and all. And made some very nice products. I had the Drake Twins for a while. It was pretty good radios. And the noise blankets did work excellent. As far as solid-state replacement sticks, you know, I homebrewed a number of them in the past. I had a Nationals radio that I used in Mobile, an MCX5. And that time, goddamn filaments alone used 15 amps in that thing. And I started bit by bit. I started to replace the tube with the homebrew solid-state circuit that one of the magazines published how to go about making replacement circuits. That you get actually a plug, you know, you get a 7-pin plug that was used as, you know, the adapters that they use, the extenders that you could test, you know, and stick the tube in on top. And you set the side second, one of them, you took out the center screw, and it came apart. So you wound up with taking the top plug that normally the tube went in, you took that off, and you used that support, that assembly, to construct your solid-state replacement stick over.
Okay. In your opinion, if Stephen wanted to make a solid-state equivalent for the Western Electric 316A, 316A2, that's in his general radio, model 857 tuner oscillator assembly, do you think that's worth tackling, or would he be better off? My gut feel is that if he went and got the tube, then, well, I'm backing off on that. A Western Electric 316A, those were fairly exotic tubes. I'm trying to remember whether or not that was used as the super low noise front end on that that fancy 2-meter converter that everyone was using. I can't remember the ham's call letters in New Jersey who worked for Bell Labs and came up with an extremely good low noise amplifier converter using, I think it was 316s or 317s for 2 meters, and it became the state of the art all in the 1975 time period. So if you were him, would you be seeking a 316 tube, or would you be seeking a solid state equivalent? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Sure, it's 1975, Dick.
In 1975, they were using it. It was a 1965 design, I believe. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, because by 1968, you could go out for $40 and buy a Vanguard Labs preamp, and everybody was using the 40736, you know, the RCA dual-gate MOSFET.
Okay, so what's the name of that? The guy's call letters were the name of this rig, this famous 2-meter converter, down converter with low noise amplifier on the front end. The AZL, is that it? Yes, the AZL. I think it was called the AZL converter. Ring any bells, Howie?
No, not really. I remember the Amico converters. Everybody used the Amico, or some guys used the Vanguard, or some guys used the Drake CC2. You know, Drake had a pair of 6 and 2-meter converters that came out on 14 legs.
Yeah, W2AZL. Can't think of his name right now. He had quite a following. I think he worked for Bell Labs, and I think it was every Thursday afternoon a bunch of the serious VH upper operators and 2 meters would get together with this man, W2AZL. As I said, around 1965, he invented this thing. He used the best Western Electric tube that was available at the time. And I'll bet you it had something like a 2 dB noise figure, which in its day was really hot. Nowadays, you go to this conference like I did this last weekend in Philadelphia, and everybody wants a 0.15 and 0.18 decibel noise figure. And we're talking about on 1296 and 2304 and so on. So the world has really changed. They're getting devices that are so good, solid-state devices these days. Even if the original device was very expensive, these guys find some way of getting a hold of a ham that works for that factory to find them a reject and so on. So these guys are getting hands on things like you wouldn't believe. I heard one horror story. A guy was on a super high microwave frequency, and there was A2 that was demanded to be destroyed. And the particular destruction guy recognized what it was, smuggled it over to this ham radio operator, who shall remain nameless. And this particular traveling wave tube with very high frequency capability, this ham radio operator is about to set it up. But when it comes to the collector of a traveling wave tube and the suppressed collector anode connection, sometimes it's a green wire, sometimes it's a red wire. So he called up somebody at the factory where the tube was manufactured and started asking questions. Which color wire is the main collector and which one is the suppressed collector? That was immediately followed by the question, where did you get that tube? And so the bottom of the story is he had to give it back. He shouldn't have asked a question. Oh, well. And he found a way of getting around the problem. So I'll tell you guys on the next few transmissions what I experienced this weekend. So I think I was slowly asking a question to Mel about this. Maybe you know what I was asking, Mel. I don't. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, well, back with the converters. Let's go back to the 60s or so. And they had a number of converters out, like Howie says, very right with the new Vista. The 6CW4, because it was rated to go to 750 megahertz. That's the way they said it, so to say. They ranged it from 250 to 750 megahertz as its good operating parameter. Now, if we flip backwards into the 40s, I mean, even remember now, because I've worked on everything of that series, there was a... some of the VHF radios at that time used the tube called the 9001, 9001, and the 9002. That was the two tubes that were very popular with the converters, 2 meter converters of the 40s, and up to maybe the, I think those tubes in fact came out in the late 30s or during World War II. They also used a tube called the 1852, 1852, which was also a very popular tube that was used at that time on some of the original 6-meter converters, but they did extend it to 2 meters. So I worked on all those. There was also another tube. They had a number of these Lockbolt tubes that were also very popular. And I don't know, I remember them being used in some generator. They used a tube called the 232, 232. It was a Lockbolt tube. And they combined that in that converter with the 784. Yep, that was it, the 784. 232 and a 784, if I remember correctly, Dick. Yes, that was the tube that, I could say back, going back now. No, it wasn't 232, it was 1232, what's the matter? 1230, 1232 was the, that was the Lockbolt tube. Do you remember the Lockbolts of the, that were used in the car radios in the 40s, Dick, over?
Yes, I do. And you're going back a little further than my familiarity. You were lucky to get your hands on some of those pieces of equipment in those days. I didn't. And tubes at the time did a lot. But once solid state started coming along, particularly FET, MOSFET and gas FET and HEMP FET, high electron mobility FET, with or without cryogenic cooling, wow. And just to give you guys a couple of words on this one. Of course, Howie, Doug, and Mel, they're going to be bored by this, but for the rest of the people, want to know what is this thing called noise figure. Turns out every receiver makes a little bit of noise in its front end stage, and that noise is going to cloud the super weak signal you want to listen to. And so to make the noise of your own front end amplifier go to zero is a difficult task, but worth pursuing. and the quality factor by which you rate the performance of your receiver is called noise figure. A perfect receiver would have 0 decibels of noise figure. That really means whatever signal level comes in signal-to-noise ratio to your RF amplifier, the output of the RF amplifier would be an exact replica of that signal, 20 decibels stronger, with the exact same signal-to-noise ratio. By comparison, a good state-of-the-art 432 megacycle receiver, 1970 vintage, had about a 4 dB noise figure. So if the signal-to-noise ratio coming into your receiver was 10 decibels from the antenna, after your first stage of amplification with a 4 dB noise figure, your 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio would degrade down to 6 dB signal-to-noise ratio. The receiver would be adding 4 dB of extra noise, so to speak. Slightly simplified example, but it gets the point across. And so there are techniques for making the receiver less and less intrusive. You want the gain of that stage. You don't want excess noise being created. And that noise will cloud your signal. Now, every antenna has a noise temperature to it. My 432 megacycle antenna aimed at the horizon. Half the antenna is looking at hot earth. Half the antenna is looking at cold sky. Cold sky is around 3 degrees Kelvin. Hot earth is around 300 degrees Kelvin. Kelvin meaning an absolute temperature. Subtract 271 from your centigrade temperature and you get Kelvin temperature. So a typical 432 antenna is going to have 150 or 200 degrees of noise temperature to it. Temperature is related to its noise power. Every time you double the degrees in Kelvin, absolute temperature, you double the absolute noise that a resistor would be creating. A 50-ohm resistor, for instance. A 50-ohm resistor at room temperature is making an amount of noise equal to minus 114 dBm per megacycle of bandwidth. And what's different about measuring noise power versus signal power, I can dial my signal generator down to a minus 80 dBm signal if I want to. And I just tell you the signal level, minus 80 dBm. Every engineer in the United States that's skilled in the art knows what that means. But if I told a guy that the noise power I'm getting is minus 80 dBm, I haven't given him a coherent statement. Noise doesn't have a discrete frequency to it like a signal generator. Noise is broadband. So until you define the bandwidth of your measurement, you haven't defined noise power. And when you do define the measurement, and I call it minus 80 dBm per megacycle of bandwidth in my observing equipment, now I've described the real noise power. And it's called noise power density, because we're describing power over a bandwidth, and they call that density. So you have to use a different set of terms when you're creating noise. Well, a 50-ohm resistor, because everything in there is at room temperature, roughly 290 degrees Kelvin. That's the IEEE definition of room temperature, 290 Kelvin, which is around 20 degrees centigrade, which is somewhere around 65 degrees Fahrenheit. They call that room temperature. It's a standard everyone uses, 290 Kelvin. Okay, temperature really means average kinetic energy of the molecule. That's what your thermometer is measuring. Those molecules of that solid inside of your 50-ohm resistor are all sitting there shaking a little bit in position. And how violently they shake is a function of their temperature. And as they shake, the electrons associated with each one of those molecules are moving around and making noise. So your 50-ohm resistor at room temperature makes noise. A very calibratable, reproducible, traceable to the zero amount of noise. Everybody really knows what that noise is. And to the nearest couple of decimal places, it is minus 114 dBm per megahertz. dBm means the dB with reference to 1 milliwatt. And so you know what a perfect resistor is going to create. You connect that resistor to your amplifier, measure how much noise that comes out of your amplifier, knowing the gain of the amplifier, going to some formulas, you can measure the quality of your amplifier. That's the crude way of doing it. An automatic noise figure indicator does it by a radiometry technique. It does it by a technique similar to what's used by a radio astronomer. And Over the last couple of days, I spent some time with one of the world's, two of the world's best radio astronomers, Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, and Dr. Tom Clark, W3IWI, and I think he's now W3IO. He's changed his call letters. Both of these guys have done some very serious work in radio astronomy. And what's the state of the art? You listen to their lectures of how they made measurements of pulsars that are in orbit around each other, and the rate of decrease of orbital period and the precession of the orbital period of orbit of binary pulsars tells you the amount of gravity wave radiation is taking place, tells you how much Einstein's relativity was taking place, and everything is nicely confirmed. And what Joe did was to on his speech that he gave at the banquet, he not only showed us some beautiful pictures of all the work behind the 2.5 million watt transmitter that's connected to the Arecibo radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. This is a 1,000-foot diameter dish. They have a 2.5 million watt, 2,000 watt, 2,000 megacycle transmitter that transmits radio pulses that you bounce off of Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, Venus, and Sun. Can you imagine making a radar that bounces signals off the Sun or off a planet? That's a radar. That's why the people in Puerto Rico call that whole installation El Radar. Anyhow, one of the things that Joe brought to our attention, which has taken place, you could be a visitor, and I think he did it. You could be a visitor where they take you up on the tramway car that takes you to the focal point 400 feet above the deck in that 1,000-foot diameter dish. You're at the focal point of the dish, and you're right at the Gregorian feed horn. A handy talkie in your hand, transmitting 3 watts of power. You key down on the handy talkie while you're at the focal point. When the dish is aimed in the right direction, wait 2.5 seconds, and you hear the signal come back from the moon 15 dB above threshold of your handy talkie. You listen to your own echo bounced off the moon 2.5 seconds later because of the nearly 500,000-mile round trip. You know, 240,000 miles to the moon and back. And because that dish has got 60 some odd dB of gain, I think it is, I can recalculate that. You go through the numbers and you say, yes, wow, that's one heck of an echo. And so under those conditions, you have a really potent handy talkie. I could do the calculation. I think the equivalent power out of your handy talkie because of the gain of that dish, that gives you a equivalent radiated power of quite a few million watts, even though the thing in your hand is running 3 watts, running on a battery. That had to be a fun experiment. Anyone have any further questions on this subject before we proceed? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I have a question, Dick, WB2HWW.
How we recognized? Anyone else?
KC2OWO.
KC2OWO. Recognized. Anyone else? More than enough. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, Dick, I haven't kept up with the newer technology. The hemp sets, how good are they compared to gas sets? And there were a company, they think in Pennsylvania, SP Engineering or someone else. And I talked to them about a year ago, and they say they're using a hemp set, but what they do is they put the helical resonator after the FET, and I was surprised. I always thought you put the tuned circuits in front of the FET, so in front of the RF amplifier, so that you wouldn't get it to go into oscillation. Whenever I hook up a preamp, I like to put the cavity before the preamp. How much better performance are you going to get with a hep FET as far as FM? I'm not talking about weak signal work, but I'm talking about mainly in repeater operations in the 430, 450 range. What is the best transistor today compared to, let's say, the advanced receiver research?
Okay, the preamp itself of advanced receiver research, in my opinion, is more than good enough in noise figure and gain for what you desire. That's the good news. There's two pieces of bad news, in my opinion. Number one, The box is nowhere near well shielded enough to survive the severe environment of 2-meter duplex repeater operation, where you've got one antenna and you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna at a co-located site. So you have to build a brick wall. You have to build a tank. That's what I'm trying to say. You have to build a very sturdy structure to do some serious shielding of the box of that preamplifier. That's step number one. Step number two, every extremely low noise preamplifier has a front end impedance matching network such that when you tune it for best noise figure, you tend to have a circuit that is extremely broadband. You may think it is a 430, 440 megacycle preamplifier. In reality, it's got a heap of gain from 100 megs to 1,000 megs. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but extremely broad bandwidth. And for a guy like you located in a metropolitan area, there is some potent signals at various frequencies across that region. You know, 3.5, 5 megawatt UHF television stations, local fire, police transmitters, and so on, paging transmitters, cell phones. Therefore, lots and lots of filtering is required. And now, you've got a triple requirement here. Number one, you want to set up the transistor in such a way that it has unconditional stability, a K factor greater than 1. And there's a whole art and science of choosing the right transistor and the right network, the right nest that you put it into so that it has unconditional stability. That's your first requirement. Your second requirement is that the front end filter has to have enough bandpass characteristics and a brick wall selectivity curve such that all these bad, strong guys that are out of your frequency region don't come roaring through your system and give you all kinds of intermods and other grief. And here's where the compromise takes place. If this is the best of all worlds, you would use a really great filter in the front end that lets in nothing but your frequency. The problem would be over. Well, the insertion loss of your filter adds to the receiver noise figure. So you want the insertion loss to be zero. However, a zero insertion loss doesn't have much filtering. So every real filter design made with finite quality factor of its resonators, finite Q of its resonators, is a compromise between how much selectivity you're going to get versus the insertion loss. If you take your tuned network, that is the front end of the filter, and you load it very lightly, you'll get very narrow band, high Q circuit, which has got beautiful selectivity, but it's got insertion loss. Load that network more heavily, the insertion loss goes down, but now it doesn't filter as well. So the best compromise, in my opinion, is some broadband filtering without ideal filtering in the front end to get rid of most of the bad guys and most of the really quality filtering after the preamplifier. If you added every bit of the filtering in front, you'd be adding to the noise figure. In some cases, you can tolerate it. You're looking for state-of-the-art sensitivity. You probably don't. So a lot of people give a simplistic answer saying, don't put a filter on the front end, put a filter afterwards. Well, if your low noise amplifier has enough intercept point that it itself does not saturate on the strongest possible signal that's going to come in, then yes, you can tolerate that. Maybe your antenna itself has got enough bandpass filter characteristics, and maybe you can put some frequency or rejecting stubs on it and so on, so the bad guys don't get through. That's a slightly risky approach, in my opinion. I would use some filtering on the front end and most of the filtering after the preamplifier. The only other suggestion for this is if you're willing to build really large voluminous filter resonators, silver plated structures and whatever, where you've got a lot of volume inside and they have a natural Q in 5 and 10,000, then you can have your cake and eat it too. You can do Dodgeman filtering in the front end with very little insertion loss. The average guy, when he buys a preamplifier, doesn't intend to buy a filter with it that is 50 times the volume of the preamplifier. So the average guy doesn't do it that way. But this is some of my thoughts on that particular subject, Howie, before I go over to the next guy. Back to you, Howie, for some comments. K2RIW in the TechNet. Doug also recognized.
I'll give it to you in a minute. Dick, yes. Up now, you can get the entire insertion loss from the antenna to the preamp. It's about a dB and a half, okay? You can get, you know, pretty tight using quarter wave, half wave cavities. But what I'm saying is this. With a advanced receiver research preamp, you can get sensitivity for a 12 dB side net down to about 0.13, 0.14 dB, about minus 120, 119, somewhere around there. You know, about minus 118, maybe 120 on the service monitor. I'm just wondering, where's the state of the art? I'm not saying I'm going to do this, but just for academic discussion, how much more do you think you need to go at UHF? At 430, you can get about minus 118, minus 119. So I'm wondering, how much more can you get out of a system?
Okay, the guys up at, I can't think of the mountain in southern New York, who had a repeater there for years and years, the guy running that one, Barry, and I can't remember Barry's call letters right now, they moved to Andrew in Chicago, and so he's gone. He was getting 0.07 microvolt, 20 dB quiet. I know that's not synod, but just gives you 8 points of marking, and maybe you can convert between the two. He was a good tweaker. He knew how to do it just right. He was getting 0.07 microvolts. When you convert that, you're telling me that 0.13 is now considered pretty darn good. And if I do a very simple log conversion on that, and if I 1.3 versus 0.07, and of course I have to take 20 logs of that. He was getting 5.3 decibels more sensitivity. To some people, that's worth seeking. That's what's possible. Now, do you really have to go that far? I don't know. But let me pick up Doug, and we'll come back to this one. K2JJ, go ahead, Doug.
All right, Doug, very good. I'm sorry, I got a quick phone call there. Did we finish up with the gentleman with the general radio oscillator? I was going to say, if he doesn't have access to the Internet or whatever, I'd be glad to print this manual out for him and send it to him.
An attractive offer, Doug. And Stephen didn't tell us he has trouble with the Internet. He knows about BAMA, B-A-M-A. So thank you for the offer, and I think that problem is gone. Howie, as you can see, there's a lot of art and science to selecting the right amount of filtering in front of the preamp, the right amount of filtering after the preamp, the right size of the filter in front. The insertion loss of the filter after the preamp is not as big a deal. The preamp's got 20 dB of gain, whether the filter afterwards has got the 1 dB of loss or 2/10 of a dB of loss doesn't matter. 1.5 dB of total loss in front of your first preamp for a guy who wants state-of-the-art sensitivity, some people think it's high. If that's the price you have to pay to get good filtering, to get rid of the intermod in a metropolitan area, it is more than worth it. So there's no exact answer here as to what's the ideal way for your particular environment. If you had a total of 1.5 dB of insertion loss from your antenna to the first stage of gain, and that first stage of gain had a good enough filter to get rid of the strong guys that have the capability of creating any substantial amount of compression of your preamp, and after that is a very good filter so that nothing but your frequencies get through, then I think you've got it made. Back to you, Howie.
Yeah, now they tell you the hemp set is supposed to give you a lot more compression. Now, the reason why I do not put a lot of filtering, the only filtering I have after the preamp is the front end circuits that are in the main receiver, is if you put too much filtering after the gas set, then it's possible that if a strong signal comes down, the gas set will go into oscillation because the filter is going to present a high, reflected, penis is going to be weird and the preamp is not going to like it. So I've always been of the opinion that you put the filtering before the preamp, and the only filtering you have is whatever the receiver has, let's say in a Master 2 or a Micor. Yeah, I'm just wondering, what can you really do if you really want to get down to, let's say, 0.08, 0.09? I've been there. The problem is, you have to stay there. If you go up there and you really tweak your filters, it'll be there for about a year or two. But when you come back, if anything changes, you can get down about point, you can get to 0.1. But I'll tell you one thing, you got to do a lot of work on the receiver and spend a good couple of hours tuning it. All right, Dick. No, because I've heard about the hemp sets, and they say that they have a higher dynamic range. And Itamod is your worst enemy. You have, you know, you have kilowatt transmitters, quarter KW signals all over the place. And you got the police department, so you got a lot of stuff coming down to your feed line. Thank you very much, Dick K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Okay, I've got some different opinions here, Howie. You're afraid to use a super good filter after the preamp, because rightly so, when you're off frequency and the signal is coming through that preamp and it's going into the filter and the filter's rejecting it, the filter rejects it by acting as a short circuit at that frequency, reflects it back to the amplifier, and the amplifier might go into oscillation. And if so, I would call that a drive-induced oscillation. But even before a strong signal comes along, the so-called stability factor, the K factor of an amplifier, if you've got the S parameters of your operating transistor and you define the environment you're putting it into, this is one of the lectures done by Al Ward, W5LUA. It used to be W5LUA, Dr. Al Ward, of used to be Agilent. He gave us a lecture on that exact subject this weekend of how to get the unconditional stability of your preamplifier. And so, in many cases, you simply put a resistor in between the output stage of the preamplifier and the filter. A small amount of padding or resistance there means that the amplifier never sees the short circuit of the filter. It costs you a dB of insertion loss, but with 20 dB of gain, that's an extremely good compromise because it's not affecting the noise figure per se, and now you've drastically increased the stability factor. Another thing to worry about is that you're going to hear lots and lots of opinions that bipolar transistors have a certain amount of intermods, FET transistors have a certain amount of intermods, JFETs, MFETs, whatever, dual gate FETs. People have all kinds of opinions as to which ones have higher intercept points. Pure bold. The intercept point of your preamplifier is primarily a function of its bias. I can take a transistor that is capable of extremely high intercept points if I use it in the recommended manner. And in some cases, guys have taken a power transmitter transistor that just happened to have a low noise figure and put it in the front end in order to make high intercept points. However, if I take that power transistor with a very high intercept point and I say, gee, I'm running it from my my portable radio, I don't want to waste a whole lot of power, I'm going to bias it very lightly so it doesn't draw much current. You bias it lightly where it doesn't draw much current and you're way back to very low intercept point. The intercept point is primarily a function of where is the 1 dB compression? What's the peak envelope power the output stage of the amplifier can produce? And when it comes to linear class A amplification, the peak envelope power that the amplifier can produce is primarily a function of, first of all, does it run out of current capability? And number two, have you biased it such that it can produce that power without saturating? So bias is much more of a factor than the device itself. If I've got 1 dB of compression in a FET amplifier, 1 dB of compression in a bipolar amplifier, 1 dB of compression in a hemp FET amplifier, they will have essentially the same power output intercept point. A lot of people miss that one. So there's nothing magic about choosing the device. It's choosing the device that has the peak envelope power capability, and you're properly choosing the bias and the way you impedance match it. Also, heavily impedance matching the output stage of the transistor tends to also increase its intercept point at a very slight sacrifice in gain. So there's a lot more to that than first meets the eye, Howie. So don't jump from brand A to brand B of transistor thinking that the intercept point is going to suddenly become glamorous. Ain't quite that easy. I wish it was. Let's find out what KC2OWO had to say. And start up with your name, sir. KC2OWO. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Can I ask one more question, please?
Stand by, we're going to get back to you. Mr. OWO, start up with your name, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. KC2OWO. Name here is Chuck. Located in Brigantine, New Jersey. A little ways from you gentlemen. I just wanted to say, I've been listening to you gentlemen for 6-7 months now, I am a general. I got licensed about a year and a half ago, and I do want to say, and I will cut it short, I do want to say that I listen to you guys every night, or not every night, every Sunday night, and I do enjoy it. I have learned a lot, and keep up the good work. And as I learn, maybe I'll chime in and, maybe get in with you guys and stuff like that. But you guys are a little over my head, but I am learning, and I do enjoy your net, and carry on. I do have to say Howie is, he's just as knowledgeable, and he is, he's your right-hand guy, and you guys are phenomenal. Carry on. KC2OWL.
Fantastic. Okay, Chuck, another testimonial. Hey, Mel, some people like us, Mel and Howie. Okay, that's good. The main reason we're here, Chuck, is to try to spread the knowledge. The real hams not only do what they think is research and tinkering and building and perfecting and whatever, and using and hopefully enjoying the process, but they do have to spread the word. Mel and I and Howie are trying to do some missionary work, in other words, elmering people, as they say, in other words, helping them along, because the books don't cover it all, the schools don't cover it all. We have to help each other. That's the way ham radio works. You listen to a banquet speech by a guy like Joe Taylor, K1JT, who, as you know, got the Nobel Prize for what he did with the Arecibo dish and pulsars in radio astronomy. And you realize that he cut his teeth in electronics, and he learned the art through ham radio and talking to his ham radio buddies. That's where it all came from. The books in the school didn't give it all to him. A lot of it that they really made it all fit together for him to get that prize came from his ham radio contacts. So that's what we're doing. When you do finally come up with a question, don't worry. Mel and I have a philosophy that a dumb question is the one that's most deserving of an answer, because it represents the greatest gap between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. And to take a snooty attitude, as occasionally people do, saying, gee, that question is not up to my level, I'm not going to answer it, that's silly. There's no profit in that. It just proves that you think that your waste products are not as smelly as somebody else's, and of course that's not true. By the way, there's a whole subject on that I'll get to you in someday. All right. Howie, I know you had a further comment. Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. Just say hello. Thank you, gentlemen. We try to help. What hearing is all about. Dick, when you go to a power transistor, and I've seen people talk about using power transistors, how much more do you raise the noise figure? Because obviously, if you're using it in a repeater configuration, you don't have to worry about power. Okay, in an HT, I can see that. But in a base station operation, okay, so if you need to run it at a quarter of a watt or an eighth of a watt, you could probably do it. If you want to run 100 MA, on the collector or the drain, whatever, you can get away with it. But what is your noise figure going to be like as you go to a power transistor? And which device today has lower noise figure? I would assume the hemp beats the gas set, right?
Good guess, but no. Let's go back to the first question, the power transistors. Many of the transistors that you and I buy, the little old guy who is really mixing the batch of materials together, putting it in the oven, and coming out with some kind of a product. He's got a die with 1,000 transistors on it, and they cut them up into pieces, and they put them on test equipment and measure them. And the ones that have super low noise figure, you give them one model number, and the ones that are not so low in noise figure, you give them a model number, another number, and so on. So there's a yield situation going on with low noise transistors, power transistors, whatever. If you're willing to select enough power transistors of the right brand name and the right model number, occasionally you get one with a darn low noise figure. And the reason why you can't go to the manufacturer with that request is because he is not selecting the transistors made for transmitting purposes. He's not selecting them for noise figure. He's selecting them for third-order intercept in a power transmitting capability situation at, we'll say, the 10-watt level or whatever. So he's selecting them differently. The physics that go into the transistor for certain kinds of transmitters, that physics, that method of manufacture is capable of very good noise figure. Not excellent, not state-of-the-art, but very good noise figure if you're willing to select them. So that's one approach. But even if you choose a transistor you think's got a high intercept point for receiver service, you can throw that all away if you bias it incorrectly and don't do the right kind of impedance matching. In general, a high intercept point comes from heavy loading of the output, let's call it the drain or the collector of the transistor. Drain, collector, yes. Heavy loading of the output circuit. That's sort of what a Cascode tuner does, Cascode low noise amplifier does, create very heavy loading of the first stage so that it doesn't easily saturate, and then the proper biasing. So there's more to high intercept point that first meets the eye. However, should you put all your money and all your effort into making the super intercept point of the preamp, or should there be the right kind of filtering to make sure that the bad signals don't get there in the first place? I would first put my money on getting rid of all the bad signals and trying to simultaneously keep down the insertion loss to the first stage. And if getting rid of every bit of the bad guys, another 10 dB, only costs you another half a dB of insertion loss, that's a good compromise. Go for it. And so you really have to have 0.08 microvolts, 0.07 microvolts. I don't think so. Not for a repeater that's in a metro area. And I guess you have to use a little bit of logic here as to where you're going to get the best bang for the dollar. By the way, Chuck, as you probably know, there is a RIP website you can go to where everything that Mel and I say for some, to a certain degree is documented. And it's only about a week or two behind the live broadcast, so to speak, and what you can read back by going to www.amateurradio.tv. Amateur radio, no punctuation, a double R between amateur and radio, amateurradio.tv, and you'll find a very interesting website by a very enthusiastic guy in New Jersey who documents every few minutes of what Mel and I are talking about, and they're all in one-hour reels, so you can go, in theory, a week or two from now, you can go to the reel of October 21, Sunday, October 21, and find out what we said between the first and the second hour, and that's the subject you want to listen to, and you find out from that website that that subject was 21 minutes into that reel, and you click on that particular reel and move your little pointer over to the 21-minute marker, so to speak, you'll hear Mel and I talk about that subject. The good news is it's all documented. The bad news is that Mel and I are doing it on the fly. We do it off the top of our heads. We've lived with this stuff for a long time, but it's not completely organized like it would if we were giving a speech at an IEEE meeting. We know with all the nice diagrams and everything goes with it. So, but the price is right, and it is available. Okay, Mel, I think it's time we... I'll get a little bit of a delay in case somebody has some kind of a burning issue, and I think you want to dig into your mailbag or tell us what those super enthusiastic guys are doing in Brooklyn. Somewhere in between, I guess, one or two of your email requests, I'll tell you a little bit more about what took place this weekend. And I'm going to tell you one quick subject to start off as to what I encountered. What I'm discussing, what took place in Philadelphia, was this year's meeting of the Microwave Update Society, group, whatever you're going to call it. A guy named Don Hilliard, he used to work for the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, back in 1985, decided that some of the really progressive ham radio operators are doing some very good microwave work. So he decided there ought to be a meeting of the clan once per year in which these people come together and share their ideas. And what are we talking about here? Ham radio operators, is roughly one of them per 500 in the general population. That's true for Canada, the United States, most of Europe, Japan, Australia. If you look at 500 people in the population, in general, there'll be one ham radio operator. is 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. One of those kinds of ham radio are the very serious, enthusiastic microwave operators that use 1,000 megs and up almost exclusively. Some of those members claim that they've never made a contact below 144 megacycles or never made a contact below 1,000 megacycles. That's just their world. Very little equipment can be bought. They're building the stuff with their own hands. And so, among the very serious microwave ham radio operators, there's one of them per 500 hams. So we're getting into a very rare atmosphere here. One per 250,000 of the general population. We've got 300 million people in the country, therefore there's something like 1,200 of these cats in the whole darn United States. It's a real subculture. And some of these guys are passionate, enthusiastic, obsessed. Microwave ham radio research to them is their raison d'etre, their reason for being on this planet. They have that degree of enthusiasm. I just went to that meeting that took place in Philadelphia. Started Thursday night, ended Sunday night. That's what, Thursday, Friday, Saturday? Saturday night ended. So, two or three solid days, these guys cut themselves off from the world. They don't listen to a radio. They don't listen to television. They've got these hospitality suites where they talk to each other to the wee hours of the morning, and they give lectures to each other all during the day. And so they tell you what's going on. You take, for instance, Brian Allen, WA1ZMS. He holds the world distance record on the 22-gig band, the 47-gig band, the 38-gig band, 78-gig band, 120, 140, 241, and all above 300 gigahertz. He holds the distance record on all of those bands. And a fantastic guy to talk to. He got Nobel laureates, whatever. There was 180 people that came together representing 8 countries and about 25 states in the United States. Rare birds. But you sit and listen to them, and wow. Concentrated information. You don't understand it all, but it's nice to know it's all there. You sit and listen, take notes, and eventually you make sense out of what they're doing. So these guys are developing fancy antennas, fancy receivers, fancy frequency multipliers, low noise mixers, fancy transmission lines, super high frequency. If you imagine a frequency so high where the waveguide is a piece of brass tubing, an eighth of an inch or a 16th of an inch in diameter. Eighth of an inch in diameter is roughly 120 gigahertz. 16th of an inch in diameter is roughly 240 gigahertz. What is gigahertz? 240,000 megahertz. That's a high frequency. That's, let me think. From 144 megahertz, where I am now, to 144 gigahertz, 1,000 times higher than the frequency you're listening to right now is where these guys are doing research. And they're finding out where, how much the signal will bounce off of a cloud, bounce off of rain scatter, hail, what kind of propagation you get with a high humidity day, low humidity day. What does a band look, opening look like in that band? Sometimes these guys are using a 30 and 40 decibel gain antenna, which is a little bit bigger than your hand outstretched, a parabolic dish of that size. When you go to real high frequencies, a small antenna can give you a lot of gain. But that surface accuracy, that'll be very high. So, these guys, some of them have got very fancy German-made lathes where they're making these micro-miniature parts that you can't buy. I mean, your choice are you go out and spend $20,000 for the part you need, or you build it on your own lathe. Obviously, what you do. Most of these guys are not rich. They're just enthusiastic. They find crafty ways of doing it. So once per year, Microwave Update has a meeting. I think the last one was in Dallas, Texas. This one was in Philadelphia. Next year it's going to be in, I think it's in Minnesota. And so I've been to 3 of them altogether, and they are mind expanding. So, just so I give you a little bit of a rundown of what took place, and I'll be telling you more about it in future weeks. By the way, for the people who really like buying ham radio equipment, this particular repeater group is going to be holding a ham fest at Levittown Hall next Sunday, a week from today, starting at 8 in the morning if you're a vendor, and
9 in the morning if you were by her. So, some equipment will be there. Not quite the equipment that I'm talking about. Bell, K2KEY, K2LAW.
And WS2N.
All recognized. We're going to take one letter from Mel, and then we're going to go over and find out what's going on in space. Or unless you had a question, Paul, is that what you're saying?
No, I just want to let you know that I really didn't have anything tonight. So maybe we'll skip this week. I just want to let you know I've been listening. I just missed the first minute or two of checking. Back you did.
Well, that's where it all happened. We made the breakthrough in the first minute or two, and you missed it, Paul. Okay, Mel, K2KEY, you got it.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, fine, but okay, if you're going to go to the Limark Ham Fest, maybe I'll try to get up and then come in late on Saturday night. We have nothing planned for Saturday night. Get in a reasonable time, get bed a reasonable time. Maybe I'll take a ride out to the Limark Ham Fest. Yeah, first I'll make a few comments. The Asterisco Observatory is quite something. I was in the carriage house, Dick, and at that time they had just, you were mentioning gas vents, they had just installed the new gas vent system. That was, I think, if I remember correctly, they said it was an 18-centimeter dual receiver system that they had just put in using GAS vent. I think you would know that receiver, Dick, over.
I'm not sure I do. By the way, in that country, they do pronounce it Arecibo. And that's the way Joe Clark, he was stationed there for 4 solid years when he was doing all that research. So Arecibo is the name of the town that's closest to that radio telescope in Puerto Rico. And it's built in a valley between two mountains. And it's a 1,000-foot diameter dish with a steerable feed horn. And the pictures that Joe Taylor showed us are the Klystron transmitter. I think it's a Klystron transmitter. It runs on 120,000 volts. The power supply has 37 microfarads. And you do a quick calculation, and there's millions of joules of stored energy in that capacitor. They got a great big discharge network. If anything goes wrong with the transmitter, they dump the energy in that capacitor immediately before it hurts the tube or hurts anybody. And I hear tell that is like a bomb going off when that particular short circuit occurs. They got the two great big large spherical objects that come together to remove that 120,000 volts from those capacitors. And that transmitter is really two transmitters running in parallel with a hybrid network that combines the power and is capable of something like 2.5 million watts of power output on each pulse that they transmit to a planet in order to map a planet with radar. So that is one hell of a radar. Apparently you had a chance to visit it, and so I guess maybe you rode that car up to the feed point. Bill, is that what you're saying? I thought that was exciting. And you were 400 feet above the surface of the dish when you were there. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I asked somebody from there that lives here. I asked, how do you pronounce this? And he says, Arecibo. Right. That's the way they pronounce it. He says, that's the correct Spanish pronunciation. Okay. It was 430 feet above this thing. And, yeah, I stood there and I looked at the tubes and the thing. I'll tell you what was really impressive is the receiving room, Dick. I'll just say a few words about that. The receiving room with all those rubidium standards and Hewlett Packard, and it has a Hewlett Packard stuff there. And in fact, the guy I was that got me there and all, my friend Bob at the time was the engineer there, and he worked with Paul HFA W1HFA. That was his Paul Zimmer. No, Hoffman. No, but that was Paul's. Paul's last name, you remember, Dick, over?
No, I do not. And by the way, you're talking about rubidium standard. It's pronounced rubidium by most of the engineers that I know, and that's the very high accuracy frequency standard. And the reason they need that is because when they're using the Arecibo dish, Arecibo dish for very long baseline interferometry, what you're doing is combining the signal you get from that dish with a signal from some other radio installation, like Hat Creek or Goldstone or Mills Cross or whatever. You combine it with some other radio telescope installation where they make it used to be a tape recording, now it's a computer disc, but you make a tape recording with exact timing marks on it in each of those locations, and you bring those tapes all together in the old days by transporting by airplane. Now you ship them by satellite to each other electronically, and at one central station you bring all those signals together and you have much of the resolution of an antenna that's as large as the Earth. I mean, if a guy on the left-hand equator and the right-hand equator of the Earth, so to speak, are both looking at the same star at the same time, those two elements of the total antenna array, the very long baseline, are 8,000 miles apart, rotating with the Earth. You have to take out that rotation electronically and so on, but you get a much higher resolution picture of that star or whatever it is you're looking at. And with radio astronomy, you get another whole view of the universe, very different from Hubble, very different from Chandra, the infrared telescope that's in space, and so on. Each of these frequency regions give you a lot more information as to what's really going on out there. So it sounds to me like you had a chance to see the 430-foot feed horn above the dish. I wonder if you had a chance to see the actual transmitter, because Joe Clark did show us photographs of the power supply, the transmitter. I don't think he showed us the receiving room. So you saw something that we didn't see in those photographs at the banquet last night. K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, I think I have pictures here someplace. Yeah, Paul Horowitz, W1HFA. He for a number of years there, he was doing a lot of research and all. He did a lot of that search. In fact, he wrote a book called The Search for the Ultra-Narrowband Signals of Extraterrestrial Origin, Dick. And Bob, I know, he was also a ham and MP4D, I think he was at the time. I knew him quite well. We went to school together. Pretty good friend, possibly, myself. So, I saw the tubes and all, that receiving room. Oh, that was the most impressive thing. That was really something, the receiving room. Not like a rack and a rack of equipment, like, you say, rubidium or rubidism or whatever, rubidium, whatever they call them. Standards and all the different things going on in there. It was mind-boggling for me. I just stood there with my mouth open, not knowing what the heck is going on here, but looked at those tanks of, what the heck is that, nitrogen gas or some goddamn thing they had there. I don't know what the heck it was to keep this thing cool. And they had these tanks with gauges on all kinds of things there. So it was quite impressive at the time. I really had a grand old time just looking at all those goody things there, it was really something that I saw those that system that they have with the deep, that liquid nitrogen into the system. Oh my God, you want to see the deep lines on the system on there? They take it broke loose or something the way it was meant to close off. I don't know. It was just a wild thing, Dick, over.
Yeah. Liquid nitrogen gets you down to 77 degrees Kelvin, 77 degrees above absolute zero, which is very close to minus 200 centigrade. About that, yeah. Minus 220 centigrade. It's cold. And then when you get really serious, you use liquid helium, which gets you down to 4 degrees Kelvin, 4 degrees above absolute zero. Or 4 Kelvins, as they say it. The good news is it gets you super cold. The bad news is it's expensive stuff, and it boils off very rapidly if any heat is being generated in the circuit you're trying to cool. And cooling that circuit is a bit of a problem because you want to couple energy, radio energy, into the circuit, which means it's a transmission line. You want the actual amplifying device to be cool,
and you have to have another transmission line coming back out with the amplified signal from your low noise amplifier, your cryogenically cooled amplifier. Okay? If I use a very low loss piece of waveguide to bring in the signal to make sure I'm not losing the signal, the waveguide is usually made out of